for Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio.
God damn, it's a brand new payback. From the straight cuts, the Mac, and straight cuts, the black. How many motherfuckers gotta pay? Went to the shelf and dusted off the AK. Caps gotta get peeled. Cause the nigga you love to hate still can kill it with. It ain't no pop, cause that sucks. And you can new jack swing on my nuts. Down with the niggas that I bail out. I'm platinum bitch and I didn't have to sell out. Fuck you, Ice Cube, that's what the people say. Fuck America, still with the triple K. Cause you know when my nine goes fuck, get a bunch of head like a watermelon, dropping tall stories up. Now let's see who dropped. Punk motherfuckers trying to ban hip-hop. Fuck R&B and a running man. I'm the one that's there with the gun in hand. Make sure before you buck with duck quick, punk. Cause I'm the wrong nigga to fuck with. Hell yeah, Sonya, better tell him. Ice Cube, better mullin' with the motherfucking LM. It's the number one crew in the area. Make a move for your gat, now bury ya. Ashes to ashes, dirt to dirt. Punch mama, not put in work. Cause lynch mob niggas are the craziest. And y'all motherfuckers can't fade my shit. South Central, that's where the lynch mob dwell. Hitting fools up with the big ass sale. One time can't hold me back. Sweatshirt, khakis, and crocus sacks. Giving juice to the Raiders, cause our Raiders never paid us. I hope he wearing vests. It's all about the L-E-N-C-H, y'all know the rest. Motherfucking crew, motherfucking mob, do our motherfucking job in a motherfucking squad. In 91, Ice Cube grew strong and bigger. And I'm the wrong nigga to fuck
one,
with.
One, two, a CD and a four.
Wait a minute.
Drop an old school beat. Like I said, it's a brand new payback. 991, let's see who beats get jacked. Sir Jinx grew a little bit taller.
Keep the whack beats out.
True motherfucking baller. And hoes can't roll on. Even bitches looking like in vogue got a hold on. Don't let me catch dough gates in traffic. I got a habit, the pillars cap backwards. I hope he wearing vest too. And his best blue. Going up against the Zulu. Break his spine like a jellyfish. Kick his ass till I'm smelling shit. Off with the head. Off with the head, I say. And watch the devil start kicking. Run around like a chicken. Grand dragon finger licking. Yo, turn him over with a spatula. Now we got Kentucky Fried Cracker. Mess with the cube, you get fucked quick, pig. Cause I'm the wrong nigga to fuck with.
All right, folks. Hey, this is Antiwar Radio. I'm Scott Horton. Thanks for tuning into the show. That was Ice Cube. Felt like getting started off with a good beat here. Get me in the proper mood. Sorry, I gotta get all my dials adjusted proper and so forth. But hey, what the hell, man? It's the radio show. Anti-War Radio. Here in a few minutes, gonna have Ken Silverstein on. He's the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, and I've got a few issues to go over with him. But I want to start it off the show today, on this Friday, with this article by Dr. Ron Paul. This is actually a transcript of a speech that he gave on the floor of the House of Representatives. Signing statements erode constitutional balance. Now, this is a man who's running for president. Recently, the General Accounting Office studied 19 instances where the president issued so-called signing statements. In such statements, the president essentially begins the process of interpreting legislation up to and including declaring provisions unconstitutional, hence often refusing to enforce them. The GAO study found that in nearly a third of the cases studied, the administration failed to enforce the law as enacted. This approach is especially worrisome for several reasons. First, these signing statements tend to move authority from the legislative branch to the executive, upsetting our delicate system of checks and balances. Next, these statements grant the president power not given by the Constitution, allowing him to usurp powers of the judicial branch. Finally, the idea of agencies refusing to enforce the law as enacted sets precedent for the type of runaway administrative actions our Constitution was expressly enacted in order to avoid. Although these signing statements are at a record high, are at record high numbers, the problem is not with a single administration. Contrary to the claims of those who raise this issue for purely political purposes, the most significant challenge to liberty presented by these statements is that they can serve to further erode our constitutional republic. I have long been skeptical of the line item veto on spending bills for the same reason I oppose these signing statements. The legislature should not yield its authority to the executive. Our constitutional republic demands that all branches of government understand and respect our system and jealously guard their own prerogatives. In modern Washington, nothing is more misunderstood and less appreciated than the genius of republicanism. Presidents issue signing statements that effectively approve in part and reject in part laws of the land, even though there is no constitutional provision for such a process. In addition, Congress cedes its powers at the crucial moment when a decision on whether or not a war is to be fought will be made, only to then criticize the effort it could have used its powers to stop. In his notes on the state of Virginia, Thomas Jefferson spoke clearly and directly about the idea of elected representatives delegating their responsibility to other branches of government, saying in no uncertain terms that since such representatives had received their authority by delegation from the people expressly for the use as representative, the legislature had to choose to either use the authority granted or return it to the people. In other words, there is to be no delegation of authority from the representatives to the executive branch of government. Concerns with signing statements ought to include a concern for the health of our constitutional republic. It ought not to be based upon the political battle of the day, regardless of whether the president is named Bush or Clinton. And without respect to any particular political interest, we in Congress need to fulfill our oath of office and protect and defend the Constitution and our republic. Our constituents deserve no less and should demand it of all of us. That was Ron Paul on the House floor. The speech was featured on the front page of antiwar.com yesterday. And, of course, you can find all of Ron Paul's writings at relevant writings at antiwar.com/Paul. And this will be the one you see. It's the last article or last speech of his that we published. Signing statements erode constitutional balance. And, you know, to me, I think that's just typical Ron Paul. Here he is running for president of the United States and lecturing Congress on why they ought to not give up their power to the president and why they ought to not stand by while he usurps their power. A man running for president who thinks one of the most important things he can do as president would be to diminish the power of his own office. And I can see it now, you Americans just saying, nah, screw it. I want whoever the establishment tells me to want. I'll vote for Hillary Clinton instead. I'll vote Giuliani. The polls say he's ahead and you gotta go with the winner, right? Forget that guy who's running on the platform of he wants to diminish the powers of his own office once he attains it. He wants to return the powers of the Congress back to the Congress and simply serve as, well, the president as described in Article 2 of the Constitution, the chief executive of offices created by Congress. Ron Paul running for president, giving speeches on the House floor against the powers of the presidency. You won't find that from anyone else running for president. And now, see, I could start talking about the rest of the candidates here, but I don't want to do that. I want to save America and Iran and Iraq and Al-Qaeda and all that until the second hour today. So I guess I'll have to keep talking about Dr. Ron Paul for another 3 or 4 minutes here. Let's see here. Oh, I got one. Did you know that your government cannot afford to go around waging wars all around the world? That our government cannot afford the empire that they have built? That if they were to tax us for the cost of the empire, that we would overthrow them? and that they know it. So how did they get around that? Well, they borrow money from foreign countries. In the case of our most recent imperial adventure, particularly China and South Korea and Japan. They're the ones who have paid for the cost of this war in Iraq. But even that's not quite enough. Even that creates a shortfall. Or leaves the national government with a shortfall. So how do they do it? Well, they print the money out of nothing. That's what they do. You've all seen footage on TV, right? The U.S. Mint, where paper turns into money because we print numbers on it. You've all seen that. Well, the actual mechanism is a bit complicated. They create some bonds, and then they sell them, and then they buy them back with new money and monetize the debt. It's a little bookkeeping trick. But basically what happens is the government turns on their printing press, and they counterfeit money. And then they spend that new counterfeit money into the economy. Well, it's not counterfeit money because it says written in ink on there, this shall be considered legal tender for all debts, public and private. So if you have a contract with someone and they attempt to pay you with these Federal Reserve notes, as they're called, and you say, no, I don't want paper, I want gold, and you take them to court, the judge is going to tell you, sorry, pal, you're going to take this paper, it's good enough. It says right on it, it's legal tender. So, you know, these paper dollars are enforceable. A court will tell someone in a lawsuit with you that they have to accept your paper money. That's what makes it money. The force of law. There's nothing else about those pieces of paper that make it money. People say, well, it's backed up by the full faith and credit of the United States. Well, first of all, the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution doesn't have anything to do with the credit rating of the United States government. It means that the different states have to respect each other's licenses and paperwork and so forth. That's what it means. And second of all, yes, to a degree, it's true that our paper money is backed up by the threat of force. It is backed up by the national government's promise to a bondholder that he will rob you and pay that bondholder whatever he paid for that bond plus interest in new paper money. And so you see, it's an unending cycle of creating bonds out of nothing and then buying those bonds off the market with new cash. And the value of the dollar in your pocket is diminished. If I knocked you down and I took the money out of your wallet and I ripped all those bills in half and kept the halves for myself, you would understand what just happened. But they don't do it that way. They don't knock you down. Well, they do that. They tax you too. But I mean, they can only knock you down and steal so much from you without getting overthrown. So what they do is they print the money out of nothing and they steal the value out of the dollars in your pocket. Which, of course, especially hurts the working class and the working poor, whose wages are always the last to increase to catch up with the rising cost of living. Again, it's not really the prices going up. It's the value of the money going down. And it's your Grammy and Grandpa. It's their savings that is being looted. Think of it as just the same thing as if you're eating a bowl of soup and I come and pour water in your soup. Well, you still have all the soup that you had before, but now that each spoonful is that much less potent, has that much less value to it, because I've diluted the supply. It's the same thing with dollars. And that's how they pay for these wars, with this hidden taxation called inflation. It is theft, and it hurts the weakest people first. And it's criminal. And it's something that Ron Paul wants very badly to change. And by the way, did I mention he's running for president of the United States? Okay, this is Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I'm going to be right back here with Ken Silverstein from Harper's Magazine. right, my friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Introducing our guest today, Ken Silverstein. He is the founder of Counterpunch, I just found out, and is the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. His blog at harpers.org is called Washington Babylon. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Thanks.
Good to talk to you. And I guess the first thing I should do is offer my congratulations on taking the email newsletter of the other Scott Horton and taking the what is must have been, as far as I know, the best email list that one could possibly hope to be on and turning it into its own blog there at harpers.org.
Yeah, we are thrilled to have Scott blogging for us, although the credit really must go to Paul Ford, the web editor, whose brilliant idea it was to invite Scott on. I can take credit for bringing Scott Horton's No Comment blog to Paul's attention, but I just said, you should be reading this. This is great. And his brilliant idea was, hey, we should try to get this guy for our site, which we succeeded in doing, and we're really happy about that.
Yeah, he really is an amazing guy. You know, literally one of a very small number of people who can legitimately be termed anti-torture heroes in this country, people who have stood up against Donald Rumsfeld and the rest of these thugs who think it's okay to turn the symbol of America from the Statue of Liberty to some guy on a leash laying on the floor covered in blood.
Yeah, no, Scott's been there from the very, very beginning. I mean, starting with executive renditions and going through Abu Ghraib and all these other abuses that have taken place. He's been really solid, and he's been, as you say, you know, standing up and very loudly letting it be known that he finds it abhorrent. So, yeah, he's to be congratulated for that.
I also have to admit that when I saw that he's going to be turning this email list into a blog at Harper's, I said, well, so much for me. I'm going to have to change my name now or something. Here goes the other. The other Scott Horton's got a list of credentials after his name I probably couldn't even read to the end of, and writes, what, a dozen blog entries a day on all the most important subjects? I can't keep up with that.
I don't know how he does it. I really don't. I'm in awe.
All right. Well, you know, your blog there at harpers.org, Washington Babylon, you have the better name for your blog, for starters, but it's nothing to snicker at. You got a really good blog going yourself here. It's harpers.org, for those not familiar, the Washington Babylon blog. And you have all kinds of interesting stuff here to talk about. But let's start with this undercover investigative journalism that you did in regards to the process for what it takes to lobby for a third world Stalinist dictatorship. And this is the kind of journalism that we don't get to see anymore. And apparently you were attacked for doing it, when this is exactly what I like to see, is a reporter pretending he's somebody else and getting in there and finding the real scoop.
Well, this was, I do want to note right off that this is, there's a small excerpt of the story on our website, on my blog, Washington Babylon. But to get the full story, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your point of view, you have to get the July issue of Harper's. The full story is there. Yeah, what I did was I basically dummied up a fake company that was allegedly based in London, said to have a stake in the Turkmen natural gas sector, and then approached a number of the big lobbyists in Washington and said, gee, you know, we're looking for a firm that can put together a strategic communications plan to convey to the American public and policymakers all the exciting changes underway in Turkmenistan. Of course, there are no exciting changes underway in Turkmenistan. The place remains a Stalinist dungeon. However, I said that we wanted to improve our, you know, we had a stake there, and the government would be very grateful to us, my company, if we hired a lobbyist, you know, would enhance our own business position in Turkmenistan. So we wanted a firm that could basically, I mean, I didn't use the term whitewash, but it was pretty well understood that what I was looking for was a company that could, a lobbying firm that could whitewash the image of the regime and seek to improve the relationships between the U.S. government and Turkmenistan. And needless to say, a number of the firms bit, and bit strong, and really went after the account.
And what was it that they offered to do for you to improve the image of Turkmenistan?
Well, you know, I talked to two firms. I went in for face-to-face meetings with two firms after having had conference calls and email exchanges. I claimed I was coming into town from London when, in fact, I was in Washington the whole time. And I met them, and I told them that, you know, I what can you do for me? I asked them, what could you do for me? And they laid out their game plans. APCO was going to charge me roughly $600,000 for the first year. They were going to arrange congressional trips to Turkmenistan. They said it would be tough in the post-Jack Abramoff climate. You know, there'd be a lot of scrutiny, so it might have to be at first a group of staffers. But they thought that they could put together a delegation of real live members of Congress. And they said that, you know, they were basically suggesting that they could use a loophole, because in the law it says that although lobbyists aren't allowed to sponsor trips, a university can sponsor a trip. And so they said, well, we can recruit a Turkmen university, and, you know, if we do that, then they can be basically the cover for the trip, so we'll be able to send members of Congress over as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, A, they said they'd send a junket of members of Congress. B, they said they'd do a lot of work on the media. They could, you know, they would have a, there's a lobbyist on staff who writes op-eds, and then they go out and recruit signatories, somebody they're friendly with at a think tank or a university, and get them to put their name on it. And then they plant it in the newspaper. They told me they had planted thousands of op-eds in this manner. They said that they could create bogus events around town where it would look independent. It would look like maybe a think tank was sponsoring it, or Roll Call, the Capitol Hill newspaper, was sponsoring it. But in fact, they would pretty much control the agenda and the speaker so that we would get the message across about the new and improved Turkmenistan. And they also said they could easily arrange trips for foreign visiting officials from Turkmenistan, say the foreign minister or maybe the president comes to Washington. They would open doors and get him in to see administration officials and members of Congress. And again, you know, they would get across the message that my phony company wanted to get across, which was that Turkmenistan was a wonderful place, basically, and things were improving, and it was time to take a fresh look at the situation there. So they were only too eager to help. Then Cassidy and Associates, which really is probably the biggest lobby shop in Washington, they said with Turkmenistan, you know, there's image problems here, so there are no quick, easy solutions. We'll need 3 years, and it'll cost $1.2 to $1.5 million a year, so that basically when you factored in fees and other costs, it was clearly going to be a $5 million-plus contract. And they proposed sort of similar arrangements. You know, they'd send over members of Congress. I mean, there were variations on the same sorts of themes. I mean, you know, they were both the firms were going to influence the media and influence politicians. I mean, Cassidy had an idea where, excuse me, one of the people who worked for Cassidy had previously helped set up something called the Valdai Discussion Group, which sends journalists and think tankers and academics over to Russia on all expense-paid trips. They are wined and dined and heavily pampered. They get, you know, top access to Russian officials, including, in some cases, Vladimir Putin. And then they come back and write about their trip. Now, some of the people who came back and wrote articles that weren't completely overwhelmingly fawning, but the stories, I would say, ranged from critical but sympathetic to flat out falling all over yourself and praising the situation in Russia. So they said we could try to do something like that in Turkmenistan as well, this sort of, you know, and something similar to this Valdai discussion group. So again, you know, they were going to manipulate the media. They were going to use friendly academics. They had ties all over Capitol Hill and the administration they bragged about. And basically they said that they could get the job done. They would be able to help Turkmenistan rehabilitate its image in the United States and improve ties with the United States government.
And so really the essence of this story is not so much illegality, but what's legal for them to do. This is how the system works. I guess the part that really you know, got the hairs standing up on the back of my neck there was they've bragged that they've planted thousands of op-eds in this manner. That's really the lesson of this story, right? Is, listen, everybody, this is the information you're getting. This is where it comes from, really.
Well, that lesson for me was there were a couple of messages, but yeah, that's one of them, is that, you know, as a reader of a newspaper or even somebody who follows events in Washington and attends, you know, think tank events around town, it seems that we don't really know what the source of the op-eds are or what the source of the events are. Was it something that someone spontaneously decided to write about and felt passionately about, or is it simply that a lobbyist contacted them and asked him or her to put their name on an op-ed. And, you know, are these think tanks allowing themselves to be used by lobbying firms? I mean, I don't think every event in Washington that takes place clearly is sponsored in this fashion by a lobbying group. Obviously, that's not the case, but it seems pretty clear, based on what the firms told me, that they are able to set up those events. And so it's hard to know, really, what's going on and what, you know, what's for real and what's just pure PR BS. The other lesson is just that the law that regulates lobbyists is obviously insufficient. And it's, you know, it dates to 1938 when the Nazi regime hired a lobbyist, a PR man named Ivy Lee. They used to cut out for him to do it so it wouldn't look like he was working for the Nazis.
Yeah, he was Rockefeller's PR guy, Ivy Lee.
I didn't realize that, but that would make sense. I mean, he was the prominent PR guy of his day. So they put into effect the Foreign Agents Registration Act back in 1938, and it's just obviously not sufficient. I mean, these firms boasted about how little they would have to disclose, how, you know, because I said discretion is the very lifeblood of our operation. We don't want any questions. We don't want any exposure. And they said, don't worry about it. We have to expose very, very little. There aren't going to be any questions for you. And if there are questions, we'll handle them and shield you from any serious inquiry.
And that's for a company that is signed up as representing a foreign power.
Exactly. And yeah, which a lot of clients, a lot of lobby firms apparently do not sign up at all. Now, these firms didn't say they wouldn't sign up. I mean, they did say that they would have to register with the Justice Department, but they said that there would be such little required of them from the disclosure standpoint that I needn't worry about any unwanted publicity. So the whole, you know, they repeatedly talked about how they could operate under the radar screen and we could get our agenda met without worrying about getting any heat from journalists or the public, because nobody would know.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because, you know, a lot of people talk about that AIPAC should have to register as representing a foreign power, but you're saying that probably wouldn't really make much difference.
Well, I mean, you wouldn't. I'm all in favor of transparency, and so any sort of disclosure is better than nothing at all. But disclosure alone doesn't solve the problem. I mean, it's also a question of the rules regulating lobbyists being tightened so that they can't do the sorts of things that they openly boasted to me that they would be able to accomplish.
This is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Ken Silverstein. He's the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. He's telling me the story of going undercover as an investigative journalist to find out about what it takes to hire a lobbying firm to represent your Stalinist tyranny back home. Now tell me this, how long were you undercover as this pretend character representing business, doing business with Turkmenistan?
Well, basically, I approached the firms I sort of started creating the cover story in January. You know, I had business cards made up, and I bought a London cell phone so I could make and receive phone calls from London while I was in Washington, D.C., you know, so that the number that popped up would be a London phone number. With the help of someone at Harper's, created a website, which was really just a cover, you know, a homepage. So we did a little bit of preparation and constructed the cover story beginning in January. I started calling these firms in mid-February, right after the new president of Turkmenistan was elected in this complete sham election in which he won 90% of the vote, ran against five members of the ruling party. Since all opposition to the government is considered treason under the Turkmen constitution, there are no opposition parties. So after that vote, I contacted the firms. This was in mid-February and, you know, said that, well, gee, there's a newly elected government in Turkmenistan, and that's who we want you to help out. So then I went in for the meetings in late February, but then for months afterwards, I had additional phone calls. I had email exchanges. The firms both were very eager to get the contract, and Cassidy sent me a 12-page proposal afterwards, you know, to further press their case, and APCO was pestering me with emails, and one of their officials was coming to London and said, could I meet with you? And expressed a keen interest in trying to further sell me on his firm. And so, frankly, I kept this pretense up until, mid-June. And that was when the Washington Post, we sent an advance copy to the Washington Post, and the Washington Post called the firms, and that's when they found out that to put it bluntly, they'd been punked. We did not offer them an opportunity to comment, and I tell you why. I mean, several reasons here. One, it just seemed completely bogus. I mean, we set out to answer a series of questions. You know, how low would these firms sink? What would they do on behalf of a dictatorship? How would they cover their tracks? This sort of thing. We had the answers to the questions we wanted. You know, I guess the only real question I had left for them was, you know, how do you look yourself in the mirror? But it really didn't seem an appropriate question to ask them prior to publication. The other reason, and really the main reason, was that they are professional liars and professional spinners, and I didn't want to give them, given our publication, you know, the time between when a piece goes to the printer and when it actually is on the newsstand, I didn't want to give them 6 weeks to start lying and spinning their way out of the story, which I've had happen to me in the past with a lobbying firm. I mean, their whole business is misrepresentation and obfuscation and, you know, I was just not going to give them 6 weeks to lie their way out of the story and use their friends at the big newspapers or the big media outlets to shoot down the story before it came out. And I'm glad I didn't give them the opportunity. They've complained about it since, and I've gotten some heat about it since from people like Howard Kurtz at the Washington Post, whose paper, incidentally, some 8 or 9 years ago when I did a story for Mother Jones about a lobbying firm completely did the bidding of the lobbying firm in sort of misrepresenting my story. So I just wasn't going to give them another opportunity to do it. I thought that 6 weeks lead time was just too much. And I, you know what? I think that they exposed exactly who they are and what they are. And I gave them the opportunity to not represent the government of Turkmenistan, and they shouldn't have done it. And if they had enough, I wouldn't have had a story, and they'd have nothing to answer for now.
Right. Well, I have to say, I really wish I had one of those buttons like radio hosts have where they push the button and the applause breaks out, you know, the laugh track applause meter thing. Because I think that's just great going undercover for 6 months and lying to these liars. That's what they deserve. And secondly, I want to say I have no problem with you not giving them a chance to respond in the article. They're a lobbying firm. They're big boys, and they can take care of themselves. And obviously, as we've seen, they can launch their own spin, and they can launch their own spin from the pages of the Washington Post through the mouth of Howard Kurtz. And, you know, I have a problem with him anyway, because he's one of the guys who said that Ron Paul ought to be excluded from the debates. So I already have a chip on my shoulder about Howard Kurtz. And then I read what he wrote about your article here, where he says, you know, this is why the American people don't have faith in American journalists anymore, is because
Ken
Silverstein will go undercover to get a story. Pardon me, Mr. Kurtz, but actually the reason we don't trust American journalism anymore is because of, well, what passes for journalism at the Washington Post most days, for example.
Well, I did a story yesterday on Harper's website. It's actually it's the first story up under my blog and where I discuss the sort of ridiculous charge by Kurtz that somehow undercover journalism has tarnished the reputation of the press. And what I said was that, you know, the press abandoned undercover reporting 20 years ago. And during those 20 years, the reputation of the press has tanked. So it's very hard to see how there might be a possible connection between the press's use of undercover reporting and the rotten reputation that the public holds us in.
Right.
And I then said that, you know, I would look elsewhere, Mr. Kurtz. There are other things that I think you might want to look at. For example, you know, maybe the public is cynical about the press because the Beltway press corps in particular is so unseemingly close to the political establishment that they're supposed to be covering, that Beltway reporters are often social equals and friends of people who really they need to be scrutinizing and not having cocktails with. And I pointed to and linked to, in fact, the revolting YouTube of MC Rove, you know, doing his Karl Rove doing his rap routine at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and all the journalists sitting there and cheering for him. I mean, that to me, I have to believe that that probably has a whole lot more to do with why the public doesn't trust journalists than anything I did in duping a bunch of rotten lobbyists who wanted to, you know, go to bat for a Stalinist government.
Yeah, well, and you point out that Howard Kurtz is married to a Republican strategist.
And he doesn't like to talk about that much in his column, but it is a relevant fact, I think.
Well, and I think we all know, don't we? Hopefully most people know that Andrea Mitchell is married to Alan Greenspan, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve System. I mean, it's one big incestuous thing. This is really, I think, the lesson of this whole article, this whole conversation is you have this combination of private and public interest in such a way that, you know, the average guy out here in Austin, Texas, you know, looking from here, it's impossible to even tell the difference. Where does Howard Kurtz end and the GOP begin? I don't know. Well, Conrad Black was just convicted, by the way. There's.
Yeah, I saw that. I noted that. That was pretty interesting. No, I mean, the reporters are literally in bed with the people they're supposed to be scrutinizing. It really doesn't heighten confidence in their aggressiveness and their willingness to go after power brokers in this town. I mean, when you go to bed with them at night, it really becomes, I think, rather difficult to seriously scrutinize what they're doing during daytime hours.
Yeah. And now, another example of this was really right after September 11th. We haven't really heard too much about this, I don't think, since 2002. But remember how the war on terror is going to go to 60 countries, including the Philippines and former Soviet Georgia? And that one just kind of, wait, what? They say they're putting American soldiers in former Soviet Georgia? What, Al-Qaeda's in former Soviet? What? And then that just kind of went away again. But they used the war on terror as the excuse to get America involved. And I think that, well, even including myself, I have a vague idea. Somewhere around the Caspian and the Black Sea or something somewhere is where former Soviet Georgia is. I bet most Americans don't even know where former Soviet Georgia is. Couldn't find it on a map for you if it didn't have the name on it. Maybe even if it did. And yet, this is a very important part of America's foreign policy right now. This is Georgia, FS Georgia, or whatever you want to call it, is it's really one of these states that's right on the bridge and is being fought over back and forth by America and Russia, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, and the current government is much more pro-Western than the prior government, and hence gets, you know, a free ride from the administration and pretty much a free ride from the press as well. I mean, I mean, the old regime was certainly not a wonderful government. It was headed by Edward Shevardnadze, the former Soviet official. But the new government has got its own problems. This is what we've seen time and time again in Eastern Europe, these, you know, like the so-called Orange Revolution in the Ukraine and the Rose Revolution in Georgia and on and on and on. In a lot of cases, it's just shifting one set of crooks for the prior set of crooks. And it's not going to make a huge difference in the lives of the people. But because people who've come to power have been pro-Western or espoused pro-Western viewpoints and are closer to the United States, then they get much friendlier treatment in the press. And that's certainly been the case in Georgia. One of the things I noted in the story, this is another story on my blog, Washington Babylon, which people can find at harpers.org, is that Georgia, this surprised me, it's soon to have the third largest number of foreign troops in Iraq after the UK and the United States, which really shocked me. I mean, they have 850 currently, but they recently said that they would more than double that to about 2,000. And meanwhile, South Korea, which has about 2,000, has announced that it's going to pull out its soldiers. So Georgia is soon to have the third largest force in Iraq. And I think that's, you know, that's something that really is very helpful to them in terms of their reputation with the U.S. government, with the Bush administration. It's very helpful to them in maintaining a friendly relationship. It's also true that it's an extreme, they're very pro-NATO and want to join NATO, and that also has helped Georgia a lot with the Bush administration. But meanwhile, you know, it's a government that has a whole lot of problems. And one of the things I pointed out in my story was that there's currently a trial going on there. There's 13 defendants, including a woman named Maya Topuria, who's a 41-year-old mother of three, and they're all accused of attempting to overthrow the government. And the trial that's underway is like something out of the Soviet era. The judge has closed the courtroom to the public, to the media, to foreign observers. The defendants, you know, they're all members of the political opposition. They may not be angels, but as far as I can tell, there's nothing really awful in their background. They are opponents of the government, but, you know, they don't have blood on their hands, as far as I can tell. You know what, though? I actually, let me step back for a second, because even if they did, they're entitled to a fair trial. I mean, if they can't get a fair trial, no matter what their crimes, then no one is guaranteed a fair trial. So the issue really is that these people should be getting a trial that is fair by international standards, and they're not. So in any case, I'm sorry, I digressed a little bit there, but I wanted to make that point. The judge has closed the courtroom. Nobody's allowed in terms of observers or media. The defendants are being held in cages, and the evidence is just extraordinarily bogus and weak. I mean, it really looks like a kangaroo court. The initially, the government charged that the defendants were plotting a coup to overthrow the government on May 24, 2006. There was supposed to be a meeting that day. Well, one of the defendants subsequently pulled out his passport and showed that he was out of the country on that day. So it was impossible that he was there, at which point the government changed the date of the meeting to May 4th. At that point, another defendant says he was at a heart clinic, a cardiac clinic on that day, and the government says, oh, well, you snuck out and attended the coup meeting.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you've got four doctors at the clinic who've said it would have been impossible for anyone to sneak out unnoticed from the clinic, so that this also seems utterly preposterous. The other thing that's really interesting is that the government's offered as evidence a handwritten statement by a man who implicated the defendants. He claimed that he overheard tale of the plot, and he provided a statement to the government on September, or to prosecutors, in September of 2006. Recently, he was cross-examined by a defense attorney in court, and he couldn't even define many of the words that he allegedly wrote out in his own handwriting in his original statement. Mm-hmm. He was asked to define the word dispute, which was in his original statement, and he said that that meant a TV debate. He said that the word imitation, another word in his statement, he defined as an attempt. And he said, when asked to define the word spontaneous, which he'd allegedly written out in his own handwriting, he said he didn't know what it meant, but he did know at the time that he wrote the statement. But apparently about, you know, some months later, he'd forgotten the meaning of spontaneity.
Mm-hmm.
So I talked to a woman who's representing Maya Tuporia, Melinda Sarafa. She's an American lawyer. And she said to me, and if I can just quote from her statement to me, she said, every day I'm in court, I wish the media were there because the situation is so preposterous. She said that Georgia is moving to what she called a super executive style of government. There's no meaningful checks and balances. And she says that the Bush administration, other than documenting human rights abuses in the annual State Department report, has, and I'm here again quoting, has done, she found, quote, no other affirmative efforts by the Bush administration to express concerns about identifiable instances of human rights violations. So I just find it a really interesting situation there. You know, we have a government that really has some very serious problems, but it's just not getting any scrutiny from the administration. And because it gets no scrutiny from the administration, the press doesn't take a look either. You know, if I wrote an article, God, I don't know, it must have been 15 years ago, called Follow the Leader, about the way the media follows public or foreign affairs. And really, you know, what happens is, and I'm sure you and some of your listeners are no doubt familiar with this, but, you know, if the president, whether it's a Democrat or Republican, doesn't matter, but if the president of the United States makes a big foreign policy issue out of a country overseas and starts criticizing that country, let's say Venezuela now or Zimbabwe, or, you know, take your pick, Iran, then the press will really, really carefully scrutinize that country and really, really look things over and look at the charges. And I think, you know, I'm not saying that those countries have no human rights problems, because they certainly do. Zimbabwe, the situation there, as far as I can tell, is absolutely awful. In Iran, obviously, there's very serious human rights violations there. And Venezuela, I think, not as serious as those places, but still, I mean, I find the coverage of the Chavez government in Venezuela a little troubling, because no one cared about human rights in Venezuela in the American media or the American government until a leftist populist took power. Prior to that, there were terrible abuses and nobody cared at all about it.
Right.
But I'm not trying to say that, you know, there aren't problems in those countries. But it's just that, why do we look at Zimbabwe but not Georgia? Why do we look at Venezuela but not Equatorial Guinea? Why do we look at Iran but not Angola? Well, it's because the president of the United States has complained about Iran and Venezuela and Zimbabwe, but hasn't complained about the others. So
right.
if Bush would start saying, hey, you know, Equatorial Guinea, that's a horrible place, I guarantee you we would see stories in the press about what's going on in Equatorial Guinea. But since Equatorial Guinea has become the third largest oil producer in sub-Saharan Africa, and U.S. oil companies have at least $5 billion invested there, the president won't say anything, and hence the press, for the most part, doesn't take a look.
Right. And on the ones that the president names that they do take a look at, they're almost entirely, you know, as a mass, the American media willing to repeat any lie uncritically. You know, what? Americans are getting blown up in Iraq and the government says Iran must be behind it all? Okay. And the fact that we've all known for 4 years that the insurgency is a Sunni insurgency and that actually Iran is backing the same factions that we're backing, the Badr Corps and the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution. Oh, well, just forget all that. No, no, Iran's behind the insurgency. Fine. I mean, that's their critical look when they're pointed in a direction by the administration.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, it's very easy for the administration to scapegoat Iran for all of the problems in Iraq and that to explain away their own failings by blaming it all on a foreign power.
Yeah. Hey, wait, let me ask you before we get too far into Iraq on Iran here. On Georgia, you mentioned that they're willing to send now up to 2,000 troops there. That can't really make a difference, I mean, in terms of the coalition of the willing on the ground there and what have you. So what is the real interest that America has with Georgia? I mean, it makes perfect sense that they would want to join NATO, but why would we want them to join NATO? What is America's interest in that land?
Well, I mean, I think in part first off, I would say that, well, of course, it's not going to change the military situation on the ground. It's useful for the administration to have foreign troops there, any foreign troops, that reduces the need for American troops, even if it's a few thousand from Georgia. And it also allows the administration to claim that there's a coalition of the willing and that we're not in it alone.
Right.
But beyond that, I think clearly that the administration and Russia are in something like a new Cold War, and there's a lot of conflict between the two countries, and that Georgia has become closely allied with the United States in that conflict between the U.S. and Russia. And Georgia has sided with the United States and the Bush administration on a number of issues, and Georgia's looking to the West. It's not looking to the East. And so that is important to the United States as well. I mean, I think you cannot look at the U.S. relationship with Georgia without examining Georgia's position vis-a-vis Russia.
Mm-hmm. And isn't there a pipeline going through there?
You know what? I'm pretty sure you're going to have to refresh my memory there. I lose track of all the Caspian Basin pipelines that have been proposed and built, and it's hard to remember which ones were proposed and which ones were actually built. But I know that it's a big energy region, and as I recall, there is that pipeline. I think I can't remember where it originates, but I think it goes through Georgia to Turkey. Is that the one?
I think so. Yeah, I'm trying to remember the name of it. The Baku
Ceyhan pipeline, I think.
Yeah. What was the name of it?
Is it Baku Ceyhan that it starts in Azerbaijan?
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? There are so many of them. It is really hard to keep track. But I'm sure you're right. There is a pipeline running through the region, and it's a big. You know, that's a region with intense. Energy resources or extensive energy resources, and certainly I suspect that the administration in planning all policy towards that part of the world is certainly looking at the issue of energy.
Mm-hmm. And again, that goes back to that combination of the private interests with the government interests. I mean, I have no problem with oil companies building pipelines wherever they want, but I don't see why the American taxpayers should have to pay for the cost of their security.
Right.
Anyway, so you also point out in your blog entry that there's this D.C. lobbyist, Randy Schoeneman, and I know I've heard that name before. He's involved in this. Who's this guy again, and what's his role in America's relationship with Georgia?
Well, I mean, he's been a lobbyist for Georgia, and he is, I believe he's still registered. I checked that with the Foreign Agents Registration Act, and it appears that he's still registered. He registered, I think, a couple of years ago. He is a lobbyist here in town. He was one of the leading architects and champions of the invasion of Iraq. He was a former advisor to Rumsfeld, and he helped draft the Iraq Liberation Act of 1998, which led to aid to some of the Iraqi exile groups, including Chalabi's organization. And a week after 9/11, he and a number of other conservatives sent a letter to President Bush calling for the overthrow of Saddam Hussein.
Oh, so he was in on that original PNAC letter, huh?
Exactly. And then later in 2002, he became the founding president of the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq. After the invasion, he started signing up clients, mostly former Soviet bloc states, to help them win business in Iraq and to help them with NATO-related issues for countries that wanted to join NATO. So he's profited rather nicely off the war.
Now, that group that you say that he founded in the run-up to war, was that the same group that was founded with the I'm trying to remember the guy's name now. I'm sorry. It makes a bad question when I can't remember his name. The guy from Lockheed, where...
Bruce Jackson.
Bruce Jackson,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, I'm 95% sure that Jackson was in on the founding of the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq.
Right, because see, when you bring up NATO there, in Richard Cummings' article for Playboy, he talks about Jackson had set up a committee to try to come up with excuses to expand NATO. Really, it was nothing but a welfare program for Lockheed, but they needed to come up with excuses to bring all the former Warsaw Pact states in, and that basically they follow, that was in the 1990s, and that they follow that exact same model in the run-up to the war in Iraq.
Right, that's right.
Very interesting. And so this guy, Randy Schoeneman, was part of that same group, and now he's a lobbyist for former Soviet Georgia.
Exactly.
Very interesting stuff. And also you point out that Human Rights Watch has criticized not just the bogus nature of the so-called criminal justice system in that country and its 99.999% conviction rate, which is even better than down here in Texas, but also routine use of torture, prison overcrowding and in serious ways, not L.A. prison overcrowding, but, you know, Georgia prison overcrowding, pretty serious stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's Human Rights Watch, if you go to their website, hrw.org, you can find a variety of reports criticizing the government and criticizing the situation there, primarily issues involving the legal system, the criminal justice system, treatment of prisoners, as you mentioned, use of torture. Yeah, I mean, this is a government where there are a lot of problems and things that... the new government has pledged to make things better. They don't seem to be making much progress.
Well, I guess real quick in the last few minutes here, can I ask you about Michael Ledeen and the Congo? I saw the blog entry here, but I'm afraid I only got to just kind of scan it. What's going on with that?
Well, there's an interesting situation in the Congo where the son of the president, a longtime crook, the son of the president is 24 years old, and he was given the job of heading up the state oil company's marketing arm. And a group called Global Witness, which, again, you can find easily on using a Google search, posted they obtained his credit card bills racked up by this 24-year-old kid who has this important post at the state oil company. And they posted his credit card receipts online, and they showed that he was, you know, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, at hotels in Paris, at the Louis Vuitton shop in Paris, the Bristol Hotel in Dubai, where he shopped at the local Rodeo Drive store. And then they also uncovered evidence that there's money flowing into this, that the credit card bills are being paid by an offshore account, which appears to be receiving Congo state oil revenues. So they posted all this information online. And I just simply noted in discussing the situation that, the Congo, to give you an idea of how bad things are there, it's an oil-rich country which even the Bush administration, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund haven't had a lot to do with and have been very critical of, which gives you an idea of just how rotten the situation is. I simply noted, but Congo does seem to have one powerful friend in Washington, and that's Michael Ledeen, another one of the architects of the war, who's now the Freedom Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And he has been an advisor to the president of Congo as a representative. He's been lobbying for Congo as an associate at a law firm called Trout Kacheris. And that firm has been paid $1.5 million by the Congolese government through 2006. So simply noted that it was somewhat ironic that the Freedom Scholar of the American Enterprise Institute is going to bat for a really, really crooked, nasty African regime that appears to be stealing vast oil revenues from its own people.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's funny. You take the dark heart of Babylon, Washington, and the neocons are always just a little bit worse than everybody else, aren't they?
It's a pretty nasty situation.
All right, everybody. Ken Silverstein, a.k.a. Kenneth Case, undercover investigative journalist. He's the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. His blog at harpers.org is called Washington Babylon. Thanks a lot for your time today, Ken. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Scott. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. 92.7 FM as well. Streaming live on the internet, KAOS959.com, for those lucky enough to be able to sign on during this all-important radio show. We're working on the streams. Some of you guys get kicked off. There's, overcrowding. As the masses swarm to hear Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9. We're working on it. We're going to try to get some more streams up for you guys. It's just taking a little bit longer than I thought, but we're going to get this worked out. You will all be able to listen to the show whenever the hell you want instead of having to feel extremely lucky for being able to get through, like it seems to be now. Here's some websites, antiwar.com. It's your best place for all the news of the day, viewpoints, and activities. And, Antiwar aficionado said when he called in the show the other day, it's not a bunch of hippies sitting around gazing at their navels and complaining about Republicans. It's a libertarian and conservative-based site. Of course, we feature all the best of the anti-war left as well. But, we're founded on the premise that we'd rather have a republic than an empire. We're not pro-socialist in any sense. We're all Declaration of Independence kind of guys. So that's antiwar.com. My blog is thestressblog.com. Take part. Say crazy things in the comment section. That's what it's there for. Thestressblog.com. And libertystickers.com, the Scott Horton section. You can get anti-government propaganda for the back of your car, which is where anti-government propaganda belongs. Just think of all those hours you spend in traffic not showing anti-government propaganda to the people behind you in traffic. It's just terrible. You got to put a stop to that, man. You got to get some anti-government propaganda for the back of your car. So go to libertystickers.com. Like, for example, here's one right in front of my eyes. This is a quote of H.L. Mencken. Democracy, too, is a religion. It is the worship of jackals by jackasses. See? That's some good anti-government propaganda for the back of your car. Am I right? All right. Now, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. And I think what we got to talk about today, folks, is the fact that America is still Bin Laden's indispensable ally. I'm not one of the conspiracy theorists who, thinks all of Al-Qaeda is just Al-CIA-da. I don't know who came up with that phrase, but it's ridiculous. I haven't seen really any proof whatsoever that that Al-Qaeda has worked for America since before they were Al-Qaeda, since back in the days of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 80s. As Brendan O'Neill explained on the show yesterday, Bill Clinton and Christopher Hitchens' policy in the Balkans in the 1990s was great for Bin Laden and helped to internationalize his movement. But, as far as I can tell, you did not have, white guys with suits and briefcases full of money landing and paying off Bin Laden. It was a stupid policy, and it benefited our enemies. That's not the same as Al-Qaeda, which is stupid, which no one has any evidence for at all. Okay, yeah. So here's the thing. According to the former head analyst at the CIA's Bin Laden unit, Michael Scheuer, American foreign policy makes us Bin Laden's only indispensable ally. There is no other state on earth that lends its hand to Bin Laden. Obviously, there's some rich people in Saudi Arabia who give some money and so forth, but it's not like the whole thing is a project of Saudi intelligence or anything. There really is no state that has Bin Laden's back or, his movement, except the United States. And I'm not being a conspiracy kook here. I'm just talking about consequences of policies. The invasion of Iraq, as predicted by dozens and dozens and dozens of famous people, never mind us nobodies, has expanded the Al-Qaeda menace. It's no longer a group, now it's a movement. When it was a group, it was a tiny little group. You know, some say a few hundred, some say maybe a couple of thousand guys. That was, you know, basically if you counted all the Arabs in Afghanistan in 2001 and, you know, tried to call them all Al-Qaeda. But almost all of them were killed, except, of course, bin Laden and Zawahiri, who, along with about 80 or so others, escaped from Tora Bora when George Bush, Dick Cheney, and Tommy Franks refused to allow the Marine Corps, who had 20,000 troops within just a couple of miles from Tora Bora, refused to allow them to back up the CIA and the so-called Northern Alliance. Which, of course, you know, the guy that they paid off to get bin Laden at Tora Bora, the guy that they outsourced the job to was, I forget his first name, but, the guy's name is Heck Marter, whatever. He was one of the CIA's, main guys back in the 1980s, famous for skinning people alive. And he was one of the guys that got paid off to get bin Laden. And he bragged just a few months ago, haha, you guys gave me tons of money to get bin Laden, but bin Laden's my friend and I helped him escape. How do you do the middle finger in English again? Said Heck Marter guy, however you pronounce that guy's name. I'm sorry, I'm not really good with some of these foreign surnames. But anyway, you get the point. They let bin Laden and Zawahiri escape scot-free, whether deliberately or otherwise. I think it's pretty likely that a decision was made. You know, we could have a lot more war if we keep our boogeyman out there on the loose rather than locked up in a cage. But, you know, I don't have any evidence of that other than, you know, circumstantial, looking at the way they appeared to deliberately let him go and the way that they haven't really tried to get bin Laden in the days since 9/11. He's still alive, still putting out podcasts from the Hindu Kush, along with his buddy Ayman al-Zawahiri, the former head of Egyptian Islamic Jihad. And as Michael Scheuer said in his book about bin Laden and the al-Qaeda movement, America's policy is bin Laden's indispensable ally. He wanted to drag us into a long-term war in Afghanistan to recreate the battle against the Russians of the 1980s. And Bush and Rumsfeld denied him the opportunity, basically. They outsourced it to Heck Marter, dude, and put all the resources into invading Iraq. And so bin Laden was denied his battlefield in Afghanistan. He was denied the ability to keep us there and bleed us to death. Give us our own Vietnam again, just like we gave the Russians their own Vietnam after we gave ourselves our own Vietnam the first time. He was denied the opportunity, but then what did we do? Turn around and invaded Iraq. Which is nothing but jackpot. Picture bin Laden at one of them slot machines. He pulls the lever and the three gold bars come up. What? America's invading Iraq? Excellent. We overthrew one of Osama bin Laden's worst enemies, the secular, socialist, fascist dictator, Saddam Hussein, the Western-backed atheist general. Overthrew him, that infidel Saddam. And not only that, but we've mounted a continuing occupation for more than 4 years, which has only strengthened and expanded the Sunni insurgency. We've backed Shiite death squads against them, which has only precipitated their alliance with modern al-Qaeda movement types. Not that they're all under the direct control of bin Laden or whatever, as George Bush claims. But we turned Anwar al-Islam, Zarqawi's group, by the end of 2004, a year and three quarters after the invasion, Zarqawi and his group swore their allegiance to Osama bin Laden and hence created what's now called al-Qaeda in Iraq. Our government, as recently as the beginning of this year, was funneling money, mostly off budget, you know, black budget money, some of it arranged through the Saudis and et cetera, and we're financing, perhaps still are, but I guess that's doubtful, but at least we're financing Fatah al-Islam, which is basically the closest thing to al-Qaeda in Lebanon. radical Salafist Sunni jihadist. And America was financing them through the Sonora government to use them against Hezbollah. Hezbollah, that's never attacked America. Hezbollah, that's not an enemy of America. Hezbollah, that didn't even do the barracks bombing in 1983. That was a different militia group that did that. Hezbollah, that has never attacked America. Hezbollah, that is an enemy of Israel, which, you know, pardon me, I know it sounds stupid, but is not a state in the Union. And in fact, is not even a formal ally of the United States. We have no treaty of alliance with Israel, nor should we. But Hezbollah is their enemy, not our enemy. TV says, international terrorism, so that you picture bin Laden. But they won't say, well, some of them will, but for the most part, they don't say that Iran backs al-Qaeda, because that's just stupid. Hezbollah is backed by Iran, not necessarily completely controlled by them, but they're backed by Iran, but they're not America's enemy. And here George Bush and Dick Cheney, Elliot Abrams, and his fellow criminals on the National Security Council, they decided they would go ahead and finance al-Qaeda in Lebanon as a check on Hezbollah. And it blew up in their face already. We've covered it on this show, the big fighting between Fatah al-Islam and the Lebanese government. Apparently, it took about 2 or 3 months for that plan to blow back in their face. You can read all about this in The Redirection by Seymour Hersh. And now here we are, gearing up for war against Iran, again a country that has never attacked us, a country that is not an enemy of the United States, a country that is our ally in Iraq, a country that backs the very same factions we're backing, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq and the Dawah Party. And here we are threatening war with them at the same time that al-Qaeda is threatening war with Iran. You saw this, right, in the news? That al-Qaeda has threatened war with Iran? I mean, this is insane. From Vineyard Sacred's blog, vineyardsacred.blogspot.com, al-Qaeda threatens to wage war on Iran. Al-Qaeda demanding Tehran stop supporting Iraq. What does that mean? The Iraqi government. The government that America supports. Cairo, Egypt, July 9th. The leader of an al-Qaeda umbrella group in Iraq threatened to wage war against Iran unless it stops supporting the democratically elected Shiite government of Iraq within 2 months, according to an audio tape released Sunday. Abu Omar al-Baghdadi, who leads the group Islamic State in Iraq, said his Sunni insurgents have been preparing for 4 years to wage a battle against Iran, AP reported. We are giving the Persians, and especially the rulers of Iran, the Persians, they mean Iraqi Arab Shiites. That's their racial slur for them there. We are giving the Persians, and especially the rulers of Iran, a 2-month period to end all kinds of support for the Iraqi Shiite government and to stop direct and indirect intervention. Otherwise, a severe war is waiting for you, he said in a 50-minute audio tape. Iraq Shiite-led government is backed by the U.S., but closely allied to Iran. Holy crap, was that in an Associated Press article? No. Couldn't be. We advise and warn every Sunni businessman inside Iran or in Arab countries, especially in the Persian Gulf, not to take partnership with any Shiite Iranian businessman. This is part of the 2-month period. So there you go, folks. If it wasn't clear enough for you, when America was backing Fatah al-Islam, the local al-Qaeda affiliate in Lebanon, here we are threatening war with Iran at the same time al-Qaeda is threatening war with Iran. And guess what our excuse is for going to war with Iran? Oh, well, Iran backs al-Qaeda, of course. But wait, it says here al-Qaeda is threatening to kill the government of Iran. They're declaring war against the government of... Oh, no, I'm sorry. Oh, okay, al-Qaeda works for Iran. Whatever, both those things are true, right? Fine. See, this is called doublethink. It's not just thinking two things that are contradictory to each other. It's thinking two things that are contradictory to each other, that you know are contradictory to each other, that you know only one of them can be true, but you just go ahead and think them both anyway. That's right. Iran controls Al-Qaeda that's at war with it. I guess just like Dick Cheney controls Al-Qaeda that's at war with Dick Cheney too, right? Iran is backing America's friends in Iraq. Iran is backing the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Dawah Party, which are the leaders of the United Iraqi Alliance that won the big purple finger election, that appointed Jafari and then Maliki to be the prime minister, that the United States has been supporting since 2005. Iran is on the same side as America in Iraq. And yet, well, and here's the news. Al-Qaeda's threatening war with Iran. Thanks for killing Saddam for us. Now could you please move on and kill the mullahs for us? They're the next enemies on our list. The Persians, says Al-Qaeda. And what does America say? What does the United States Imperial Senate say? 97-0? They accuse Iran of killing Americans in Iraq. They pick up Joe Lieberman and Michael R. Gordon's talking point, and they've basically declared war. Justin Raimondo said it in his article today on antiwar.com. I hate to just echo the thing, but this is all what I was going to say yesterday, except I ran out of time reading that Nation article by Chris Hedges about American atrocities in Iraq. But, you know, Justin put it right in his article. It's called, Is War with Iran Inevitable? And he answers, yes, it is. It is inevitable. The stupid Imperial Senate just passed an amendment 97-0 accusing Iran of being behind the deaths of American soldiers in Iraq. Which is just a lie. It's just not true. So here we are. The American invasion of Iraq has empowered Iran, has spread their influence, imported the Iranian Revolution into the south of Iraq, where they are backing the majority government, the same one that we're backing. And, I don't know. I guess it's no big deal, right? We'll just go to war with Iran. And we'll back, I don't know, who? Maybe we'll get former Soviet Georgia to come and invade and take a side in this thing. And of course, this is all very convenient for our political leaders who want a permanent war. And the more powerful we make Al-Qaeda, the more war we have for later. Hey, looks like somebody's calling in. I guess I should have given out the number if anybody else wants to call in. It's 512. Oh, where'd it go? Well, man, if I just kicked you off, I didn't mean to. I meant to hit unmute. So call back if you want. Sorry about that. Shit. Somebody was calling in. 646-6446-646-6446. 512 if you're calling from out of town. 512-646-6446. So here's the ABC News. Says there's a new national intelligence estimate out. I don't know if they've had the declassified version released yet, but ABC News is reporting that the new CIA national intelligence estimate says that the American invasion of Iraq has strengthened them, that they're as strong as ever before. The conclusion obviously being that George Bush's policy has made everything worse. See, they start with the false premise, which I don't think they really believe, but they want you to believe, that these people hate us for our freedom. And the solution to that, then, is, one, to take away our freedom so they don't have to hate us for it anymore. But then the other solution is to give them freedom. that is, invade their countries and occupy them. That's giving them freedom. And then when we give them freedom, they'll stop wanting to kill us. Except, of course, that's ridiculous, because invading countries and occupying them is not giving people freedom. It's invading and killing and occupying them. And in fact, that is why they hate us. It's not because we're free. It's not because of religious fanaticism. They hate us because we keep invading and occupying their countries. You see? So, more of the same makes matters worse, not better. Right? Invading Iraq has made matters worse. And look, all this information's been out all along. Robert A. Pape wrote the book Dying to Win, explaining that occupation is what causes suicide terrorism. The Christian Science Monitor and the Boston Globe reported a couple of years back now that the Israelis and the Saudis had done joint studies where they actually tracked the individual foreign fighter, pilgrim, jihadist types who went to Iraq in order to shoot Americans and, you know, get practice to be trained. And what they found was that 99.9% of them were radicalized by the Iraq war itself. They became terrorists after the invasion of Iraq. The Saudis and the Israelis independently at the same time concluded that the only role that the old Afghan Mujahideen from the 80s, or even the old Bosnian Mujahideen from the 90s, played in the foreign fighter terrorist types going to Iraq to fight was in the recruiting, in the sending them off to war. And the guys who are doing the fighting, all young guys. All people who've been radicalized by the war itself, concluded the Israelis and the Saudis more than 2 years ago. Porter Goss, the former head of the CIA, said the same thing to the Senate. We've created a massive new training and recruiting ground for Al-Qaeda. And he was in Operation 40 with all these guys. And he's one of them. And he admitted as much to the Imperial Senate. This is years ago. We've known this. And now the excuse to stay is that we have to stay to fight Al-Qaeda. But Al-Qaeda, such as it is, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, only exists because of our invasion. It's only been strengthened because we turned to the Shiite death squads and called it the El Salvador option and sent them off to go murder local Sunni insurgent leaders, who then turned to an alliance with Al-Qaeda in Iraq in order to wage their war against the Shiites and the Americans. Again, the Shiites, who are backed by the Americans and the Iranians at the very same time. The only reason Al-Qaeda in Iraq exists is because of the American occupation. And yet that's the loophole to keep our troops there. Yesterday, the House of Representatives got a report from the military that said that Iraq is a total basket case, that, you know, the benchmarks are all, not being met. And the House voted to end the war. The House said, that's it, we're mad, let's vote to end the war, everybody, by next spring. Oh, with one massive and glaring exception, and that is, keep as many troops in country as you need to fight Al-Qaeda. Anyone ought to be able to tell you by now that we are not going to kill the last of the Al-Qaeda guys in Iraq until there are no more. That is impossible. It is the presence of American soldiers that allowed them to exist in the first place. It is the presence of American soldiers that has absolutely failed to destroy Al-Qaeda in Iraq in the 4 years they've had to destroy it. Oh, I'm sorry, it didn't exist until the end of 2004, so it's not quite that long. It is impossible for the American military to get rid of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, to defeat Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They can't. Their occupation caused Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They've been unable to destroy them for years in a row now. And now this, according to the Democrats, is the reason American forces can stay indefinitely? Let's get this straight. The Democrats could end the war right now. Oh, we can't, says John Kerry on TV 2 days ago. Oh, we can't because we don't have the votes. We need 60 votes in the Senate to end the war. No, you don't. No, you don't. All you need is 51 senators who will not pay for further warfare. You don't need to pass a new law with a veto-proof majority saying get out. All you have to do is stop giving them the money to fight it. And by the way, don't say, oh, man, that's abandoning the troops in the field. As George Bush tried to claim the last time they tried to ram through their bogus, loophole-filled timetable bill. There's hundreds of billions of dollars in the DOD right now. They have all the money they could possibly need to get our forces out of Iraq safely and, you know, in a deliberate fashion. They have all the money they need to do that right now. And, you know, to think that George Bush is going to come out and say, oh, the Democrats just want to abandon the troops in the field by cutting off the money. Well, what's he saying there? He's saying if they cut off the money, he's going to just leave our troops in Iraq. He's the one in charge of the military. He's the one who's the commander in chief. If the Democrats cut off the money, he's not going to tell them, all right, guys, pack up your shit and start heading out of there with as much money as we got left to get you out. No, he's going to leave them there to die. He's going to abandon them in Iraq. He claims. And then says that would be the Democrats' fault? The Democrats want to abandon our troops in the field? What, just leave them there? Does anybody believe that that's what the Democrats want? Hell, the Democrats don't even want a withdrawal. The Democrats keep passing George Bush timetable bills with loopholes you could drive an entire Imperial Washington Babylon through. Stay as long as necessary to fight Al-Qaeda till they're gone, huh? Well, that'll only take 1,000 years. But then we'll withdraw. Oh no, we gotta train up the Iraqi army that we've been training up for years now that doesn't have even a single battalion that's ready to fight. The Iraqi army that McClatchy newspapers reported a couple months ago, they're not even attempting to train anymore. And they had, what, 6 or 10 sources for that article over there at McClatchy newspapers. Oh, no, we're not even training the Iraqi army anymore. Now it's just up to the American soldiers to defeat the Sunni insurgency themselves. Yeah, they're just going to defeat it. All they got to do is kill a few more people and the last of the insurgents will be gone. And no more will be created in the wake of the killing of the ones that are there now. And meanwhile, I sat here and read to you on the air for 1 hour and 15 minutes yesterday, these soldiers talking about doing thousands of raids. How many raids did I do? Thousands. How many doors did I kick in? Thousands. How many Iraqi people did I hold a machine gun to in their house in the middle of the night as me and my buddies went through and destroyed all their property looking for evidence that they're part of the insurgency? Thousands. And how many insurgents did I find? 4. That was what the soldiers were telling Chris Hedges and the folks at The Nation magazine. Yes, I raided thousands of Iraqi homes. I found 4 insurgents. And of course, if we could only put ourselves in the shoes of the Iraqi people for a minute, those 4 hardcore insurgents aren't evil, aren't even criminals. In fact, they're heroes. They're the people who are willing to stand up and even give their lives fighting against a foreign occupation. Those 4 hardcore insurgents. You know, yesterday they talked about how what it's like to go in that Nation magazine article, talked about what it's like to go driving around playing the IED lottery, getting killed by enemies you can never see. And how after years and years of this, one squad got fired on by a 14-year-old kid hiding in some garbage by the side of the road who popped up with an AK-47 to take on a whole convoy. And they all opened up on him, ripped his body to shreds, I believe was the exact quote. Found out upon inspection that the kid was no more than 14 years old. He was a young kid. And yet still, some major proportion of the group of American soldiers who shot this kid to death took the opportunity to take great pleasure in the fact that they actually had the opportunity to shoot back at someone who was shooting at them. There's your insurgency, a bunch of ghosts. That's the insurgency that the American military is going to defeat all by itself now, since they're not even trying to train up the Iraqi army anymore. Hey, you know, it's funny, extended family member of mine who served in Vietnam, I said, geez, did you guys see the news that they're not even training the Iraqi army anymore? They're not even pretending anymore. And he said, yes, the same thing happened in Vietnam. Train up the locals to fight in our place. Yeah, right. Like the people of Iraq are going to fight to prop up the American Vichy government. What a joke. Of course they're giving up training the Iraqi army. The Badr Brigade already has all the training and weapons that they need. They don't have any intention of being the army of all of Iraq. They just want to be the army of Shiistan in the south. And you might notice those benchmarks if you look and see which benchmarks that they've succeeded at and which ones they failed. One of them is to push for regional autonomy. One of them is to push for federalism. Which is, of course, the goal and the motive of Iran. That's right, America continuing to back Iran and their every whim in Iraq. As George Bush and his administration continue to go on TV and to tell the American people that their goal is to create a multi-ethnic, stable, so-called democratic government. An end of the Civil War, and then we can go. In fact, America's backing the Iranians against all the nationalist factions. Against Sadr, against the Sunni Baathists, against the Sunni religious leaders, against the Kurds, against all the people in Iraq who want to keep Iraq, Iraq. And America will not let that happen. They will continue to back the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and their Badr Corps death squads who are under the control of Iran. And now they are even pushing for federalism. They're pushing to just give the south of Iraq to Iran at this point. And they're pushing to break up, to halt any idea of having a multi-ethnic nationalist government there. Which of course only gives the Sunnis, who have been mounting this insurgency all along, more reason to fight. They've already been almost entirely cleansed from Baghdad. Cleansed, that's the term for it. Sorry, it's not my term. They've almost all been driven out of Baghdad, the Sunni Arabs. They live on land that has a little bit of oil, from what I understand, but none of it is developed at all. All the developed oil resources in the country are in the north and the south. And the Sunnis, who basically have ruled the Shia Arabs for 1,000 years, and particularly the last 50, they're going to be completely cut out of the oil wealth from the north and the south under the federalism plan. And so they have, again, all the more reason to keep fighting. And people keep saying, and it may be right, it may not. I mean, you look at what happened when America left Vietnam, which, not that I'm saying we should have stayed and won, because obviously the war was lost from the day America invaded that country. We had no right to win, and we, the American government, killed millions of Vietnamese and got millions more killed in Cambodia and so forth. But when America left Vietnam, the people who had thrown in their lot with the Americans, they got it bad. Hundreds of thousands of them killed, thrown in camps and tortured and who knows what. And then, of course, the genocide in Cambodia was a direct result of American intervention in that war, bombing the Khmer Rouge from the same planes that were bombing the Viet Cong and forcing them into an alliance together, and then leaving right as the Khmer Rouge were ready to march on Phnom Penh, killing another, what, 1 million or 2 million people there. And, I guess that's just the way it goes. Fact of the matter is we had to leave at some point. And the fact of the matter is that when America leaves Iraq, the Iraqis who have thrown in their lot with the American Vichy government, those who haven't already fled the country. Boy, they're going to get it, probably. The people who've thrown in their lot with the Americans. There probably will be an increase in bloodshed. However, in terms of, you know, the Vichy cooperators, yeah, they're facing a pretty dark future, I think. But the rest of Iraq right now, I think, would be much better off. And it's a gamble. What the hell? I'm not the one in charge anyway. But I think all indications are that the people of Iraq would be a lot better off if America were to just leave. Right now, America is backing the Iran factions against everyone else. It's been the case for more than half a year now that Muqtada al-Sadr, who is no angel but is certainly no more evil in terms of putting drills in people's heads than the Iranian-backed Badr Brigade, Iranian-slash-American-backed Badr Brigade, but Muqtada al-Sadr, who is not a tool of Iran. Notice how all the propaganda says Sadr is the tool of Iran, when in fact he is the only Shiite leader who's a nationalist. It's the guys we're backing that are the tools of Iran. The Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Dawah Party, they were created by the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran. They lived there for 20 years. They're the ones backed by Iran, not Sadr. See, they're lying to you. Oh, Sadr's backed by Iran. No, he's not. It's America's allies that are backed by Iran. Sadr is the nationalist. Sadr, for more than half a year now, has been trying to form a multi-ethnic government with the Baathists and the local Sunni religious leaders and with the Kurds. They're calling it the government of national salvation. You might remember a month or two ago, Sadr called out a massive protest in the streets, and they weren't waving pictures of Sadr in the air. They were waving nationalist Iraqi flags. And they were joined by Sunnis en masse. Was it 50 or 500? I forget how many thousands and thousands and thousands of people it was. Regardless of the pictures you may have seen at the National Review or whoever who tried to play it down and show one town square full of people, there were miles and miles of roadways jam-packed with protesters. And again, they're not our enemy. Muqtada al-Sadr is not our enemy. Last time Sadr's Mahdi army had a real battle with the American forces was in August of 2004. They're not the ones fighting Americans. They're the ones trying to create a nationalist multi-ethnic government there, and America will not let them. And yeah, so I don't know. This rant is not very organized. What do we have? We have America helping Iran and Iraq. We have America helping Al-Qaeda everywhere else as we prepare to wage war on Iran. We got 3,600 Americans dead for nothing so far. Oh, sorry, that's 3,611. Dead for nothing so far. And now we're ready to spread the war into Iran. See, I like to think that couldn't happen. I like to think that's politically impossible since Bush's approval rating is below 30%. But the problem is, the Democrats want war with Iran too, and in fact, if they can have Bush do it and not have to take the responsibility themselves, that's probably all the better. But the Democrats are in the pocket of the Israel lobby too. And so they want war with Iran too. And, you know, let's not be confused. It's the Israel lobby that wants war with Iran. There are no American interests in favor of war with Iran. I don't know, maybe some of the guys at Lockheed, maybe some members of the military-industrial complex, but the oil guys don't want it. The old Anglo-American establishment doesn't want it. I mean, hell, the permanent government, as Gareth Porter calls it, doesn't want it. And, you know, as we know from his reporting, and the reporting of Steve Clemens at the Washington Note, and old what's-his-name, the whiny guy at Time Magazine. We know. Now, that Rice, Negroponte, and Burns at the State Department, that Secretary of Defense Gates at the DOD, that General Hayden at the Central Intelligence Agency, Mike McConnell, the National Intelligence Director, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and even the head of CENTCOM, Admiral Fallon, are all opposed. All opposed. The military is opposed. The intelligence community is opposed. The State Department is opposed. Everybody is opposed, except for the Vice President. And all his friends, who are all, of course, a bunch of Israel firsters. Now, what Dick Cheney has in mind with all this, I don't know. And Gareth Porter says he thinks it's just Ahab and the whale at this point. And that very much may be the case. I don't really know what motivates Cheney. But I know that the only people in this country who are for war with Iran are people who put Israel first. I mean, let's be clear about this. Norman Podhoretz said on TV, into the camera, what will be the result if America bombs Iran, as I pray they do? Well, it will unleash a massive wave of anti-Americanism all around the world. It will be horrible for America, says Norman Podhoretz. And then he says, I don't care. I guess it's sort of like if you yell stop the U as the subject is understood at the beginning. I guess I don't care about America. I only care about Israel is the understood but left out, you know, the silent vowel or something in Norman Podhoretz speak. But he came out and said it. He admitted it. He said, oh, yeah, war against Iran will be so bad for America. Boy, let me count the ways. But I don't care. It's the Israel lobby that's behind this war. And it's the Israel lobby that's going to take the blame for this war. So I guess my advice to you guys at AIPAC is let's hope you get that place entirely nuked off the face of the earth. And for that matter, let's hope that every Arab and Muslim is completely nuked to death by the American government. Because you're not going to have an ally in America after this one. The American people are going to abandon Israel after this one. You're going to be on your own after this one. So if you Israel lobby types are successful in getting this war with Iran, you better make it an entire nuclear holocaust. Because you're going to be on your own from now on. The American people are not going to take too kindly to have their nation destroyed by a fifth column of, traitors. Inside their government, destroying their country for the interests of a foreign power, and admitting it beforehand. Yeah, we are dumb. We are slow, as the American people, if there's such a thing. It takes us a while, and no, we probably won't have our act together to stop you until after the war, and it's too late. But the next war for Israel is going to be the last one, I promise. The American people are not going to continue to put up with this. And again, there is no other interest in this country. Other than, you know, maybe the guys at Fox News want good ratings. But Zbigniew Brzezinski, who has long been associated with the American establishment, who was the protege of David Rockefeller, who was the national security advisor to Jimmy Carter and has been the Henry Kissinger of the Democrats for 30 years. For 40. Brzezinski went and testified before the Senate and said, please don't let them do this. You can't let them bomb Iran. This is going to destroy all the empire I've worked so hard to build. Don't do this. We'll own all the real estate between Israel and India. We can't afford it. We can't do it. He gave a speech, according to Gareth Porter, a great reporter, that rhymes with his name, maybe that's why he's a reporter for a living. According to him, he went and saw a speech by Zbigniew Brzezinski where he even said that he wants to see the power of the presidency diminished. He wants to see Congress act immediately to permanently diminish the war-making power of the president. Imagine that. An American imperialist on the caliber of Zbigniew Brzezinski saying it would be worth it to him to have the presidency permanently reined in, rather than allow for the chance that Bush and Cheney are going to be able to get a war with, get away with waging another war, this time against Iran. That smacks to me of emergency. When Zbigniew Brzezinski, not just in front of the Senate, when Zbigniew Brzezinski is going on The Daily Show, going on Jon Stewart to say, Jon Stewart, man, they want to bomb Iran. We got to stop them. What are we going to do? Seems like an emergency to me. And again, Hillary Clinton broke back Obama, and John Pretty Boy never grew a whisker on his face in his whole life. Edwards, all of them are in favor of war with Iran. All of them say that all options must remain on the table, including the use of first strike nuclear weapons against a non-nuclear country that has never attacked us. I'll tell you, I ain't this crazy of a kook, but I can imagine, I could see like somebody writing a novel where it turns out that George Bush and Hillary Clinton and all these guys are really KGB, and this whole thing's just a plot to destroy America, because I can't think of a better way to do it. What way could anyone possibly destroy America other than turning it into an empire so overextended that it destroys itself, as all empires do? But, you know, they're probably not KGB. They're just really stupid. And they put the interests of a foreign power first. America has enemies in the Middle East. The good thing about that is that they're a stateless band of pirates who you might be able to fill a pirate ship or two with. I know, I'm talking about old school pirate ships. They're really pretty small compared to, you know, ships nowadays. We've got what I think is a pretty reasonable estimate from Philip Giraldi on this show, a former CIA counterterrorism officer who does not buy into this bogus terror war, who says that, hate to really put a number on it because I don't know for sure, but I think probably there may be at the most 2,000 or 3,000 actual Al-Qaeda guys in the whole world, probably much less than that. That's at the high end, maybe a couple of thousand guys. But they're a stateless band of terrorists. They're not Iran. You know what? Here's Iran's ties to Al-Qaeda. Iran has 5 Al-Qaeda guys under house arrest in their country. They would be in prison in America or down there at Guantanamo Bay, where the military commission system on one side of the fence resembles exactly the military commission system on the other side of the fence in communist Cuba. But the American neocons ruined the Iranians' offer to turn these Al-Qaeda arrestees over to us. They said, yeah, we'll trade you for a few Mujahideen al-Qaeda. And the neocons said no. And Dick Cheney's all said no. So, yes, it's true. There are 5 Al-Qaeda guys in Iraq. They're all under house arrest. They've all been offered by the Iranians to be turned over to America years ago. And, you know, homeboy, I forget who it was. Who was it on LouRockwell.com today has an article about this, where, of course, he quotes the fascist Neil Bortz, who likes to pose and pretend that he is somehow a libertarian, which is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And I'm sorry, I don't see the article in the vault here on LouRockwell.com, but there was somebody who just wrote a modest proposal or whatever, where he said, hey, look, I'm reading in the newspaper that Al-Qaeda is threatening to declare war against Iran. And I turn on the radio and there's Neil Bortz saying, Iran backs Al-Qaeda. Iran's responsible for Al-Qaeda killing our guys in Iraq. We have to invade them. Is it not obvious which of those two is the big lie? Yeah, guess what? It's the one coming from Neil Bortz, who, in fact, I don't think is so much a liar as just an absolutely retarded idiot who, you know, doesn't have the brain cells to rub together in his brain to figure out that, no, the Shiite mullahs in Iran do not back Al-Qaeda. They were helping us torture Al-Qaeda guys before, accepting our renditioned terrorists. They were helping us fight the Taliban in Afghanistan. They've been helping us back the Shiite government against Al-Qaeda in Iraq, lo, these past 4 years. And they've offered to turn over the Al-Qaeda guys in their country who are now under house arrest to the United States to be tortured to death, and were turned down. So I really should have, like, tried to write this thing in an outline here somewhere. It's really kind of an unorganized sort of rant, but, you know, what the hell, it's Friday, it's my birthday. Here's the thing. America's backing Iran at the same time we're threatening to go to war with them, even though they've never attacked us. The only people who really want war with Iran are the people that make up the Israel lobby in this country and the right-wing crazy Likud party in Israel. Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda guys. And Dick Cheney. Everyone else is opposed. And in fact, if you couldn't think of a good reason to oppose war against Iran, how about that's what Al-Qaeda wants, is for America to wage war against Iran? Is that a clue that maybe you've been had by a fifth column in this country known as the Israel lobby? Maybe you've been had? Possibly? Al-Qaeda considers Iran an enemy, and that's why we have to fight them? Is that it? And don't call me an anti-Semite, because my grandma was Jewish, and that means you can't call me an anti-Semite, so fuck you. I'm in favor of the state of Israel, whatever. I don't care if it was created by the United Nations and recognized into existence by the butcher Harry Truman, whatever. It's none of my business. That was a long time ago, a long time before I was even born. I'm all in favor of Israel as much as I'm in favor of the existence of any state, which is really not at all, but whatever. People want to have Israel in the Middle East? Fine. And stop making me pay for it. And stop making me and my neighbors the victims of terrorists who come to kill Americans because of our support for this foreign state. I can't see the purpose behind it. It's not really treason, because treason is actually defined in the Constitution as support for an enemy. But again, actually, I guess this is, right? It's support for Israel, but at the same time, it's support for Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda network. Sounds like treason to me. And never mind that it's all based on lies. They don't have a single fact to assert to justify war. Nuclear weapons program, completely bogus. Supplying the bombs that are killing our guys in Iraq and Afghanistan, lies. Threatened to wipe Israel off the map, wrong. Backs Al-Qaeda? No. At war with Al-Qaeda. Every lie, everything they say to justify war with Iran is a damn lie. That ought to be a clue. And yet, what do we get from the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate? Let's go get them. They're killing our guys. Joe Lieberman's right. Iran is already at war with us. How long are we going to sit back and take it? 97 to nothing in the Imperial Senate. And that's all George Bush needs right now. The casus belli has been affirmed by Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. I can hear them now. Even Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton say that Iran is responsible for killing our guys in Iraq. What are we waiting for? The casus belli has already been ratified by the opposition party. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going? So,
what's happening?
Not much, man. I've been thinking about the whole stuff I've been talking about a lot lately, too. I actually read a book called Economic Hitmen.
I've been looking forward to that, but I haven't had a chance to read that yet. How is it?
Very good book. The points you're making, and like talking about like we need to do better things for the government or for the environment and all this. We need to be better people. But really, the crazy thing is by supporting our government and by consuming, that's the only way we're going to bring a stop to the evil of our government. And it's kind of a real weird treasonous sort of situation where by supporting our government, we actually are committing treason, because by our government committing its wars and whatnot, it's going to bring its own end.
Well, I see what you're saying, although Well, I honestly, man, I don't want to see collapse. I want to see the American people embrace reason and bring this empire home because it's the smart thing to do. If we have
the only way that it's going to become better is if it collapses first.
Well, you may be right about that, but you know, I brought up that concept one time to Justin Raimondo during an interview, and he said, "Yeah, well, you know, that's what the socialists and the communists used to say in Germany after Hitler, us." Well. Yeah, they got their collapse, and they got to be the socialists in charge. Was it worth it? Hardly.
Right, right. But it's kind of a sad situation where by supporting our government, we're going to end up bringing its own collapse down upon it.
Yeah. So, well, I see what you're saying. I mean, I have to go with the Ron Paul point of view on this, which is we've got to come to our senses, we've got to end our empire so that we don't lose our republic, so we don't lose our Bill of Rights. Because honestly, you know, if we have a collapse like the Russians had a collapse, our government is going to put the clamp down on us like we can't even imagine. You know, if we have another, you know, depression style amount of instability or what have you in this country, they're going to clamp down on us like nobody's business. The Bill of Rights from 1791 will be gone forever at that point. And I don't want that to happen. I want the American people to listen up and get it through their thick fucking skulls that you can't go around taking over the whole world because you're going to end up living under your empire too. And you don't want that. You know, or worse, you're going to find your money completely debased, your savings completely destroyed, your property reduced to nothing in value, and you're going to lose everything too. And when people understand that, hopefully they'll, you know, start supporting some libertarians in the primaries and so forth.
Definitely.
Yeah, I definitely see your point, though, man. And I'll tell you, you know, it's kind of, I was trying to make a joke about, you know, Hillary and Bush being KGB and deliberately plotting to destroy us. But I don't think there's a better way to destroy this country than to do what they're doing. I mean, what are you going to do? We got two mountain ranges. We got two oceans. We got two friendly countries to the north and south of us. We got 500 million privately owned firearms for 300 million people. And that's when you include the women, the children, and the old ladies. America cannot be defeated. There's only one way to destroy America, and that is what our government is doing to us now. I don't blame a conspiracy nut for wondering whether this is all really some treason that has ultimately as its goal the destruction of this country. Sure seems like it, the way they're acting.
Yeah, well, I don't know if they actually had that in mind. I think they just had greed in mind. They're all trying to just bet in their pockets, and then, you know, someone's got to suffer for every consequence or for every action there's a reaction.
Yep, that's it. It's imperial hubris, man. Completely unrestrained.
Yeah, and calling ourselves the richest country in the world, that means that there is a poor country out there, or many, many poor countries out there, to justify our wealth. The richer we get, the worse off the rest of the world is. And until we start realizing that, we're just we're just committing evil every day.
Yeah, well, that's not entirely true. We can all get richer together. We don't have to bring down America's standard of living to raise the rest of the world up. But you're sure are right that our plan now is not to bring them up to our level, but sure seems more like bringing us down to theirs. But we're all out of time. Hey, thanks a lot for calling in.
All right. Well, I just want to say one little quote. We stand as tall as the bodies beneath us.
Oh, Lord. All right.
Remember
thanks,
that. It's a little bit of a depressing thought, but have a good day.
All right, appreciate that. Okay, folks, we're over time. I'm out of here. This is Chaos Radio 95.9 Austin, Texas. I'll be back here to yell at you Monday, 11 to 1 Texas time, on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin. And now I got to pick out a song to play for you. Ooh, I know.
Looking through a window shield, falling into Well, Dying to Win is a very important book. Of course, Michael's book on Imperial Hubris, these are all important books. But Dying to Win is critical because Pape is the only one that has gone back and studied several hundred individuals who committed suicide terrorism to try to understand their motivation. And when I started reading his book, I was convinced he was wrong on his thesis, because his thesis was that it wasn't religious fanaticism. And, you know, we've all heard that, and I accepted that. So I said, well, I'm going to read it anyway, but I'm skeptical. But by the time I finished it, he convinced me that, you know, religion can't be ignored, and that's part of it, and their religion's different than our religion. But the number one cause was occupation by a foreign power. And he pointed out some important issues. He said the country that has the most suicide terrorism is Sri Lanka, and that isn't even Muslim. That has to do with the Hindus and the Indians, you know, fighting with each other. But they commit a lot of suicide terrorism. And the most radical countries that have more radical Islamists, Iran and I think Sudan, they don't commit suicide terrorism, but they came from, you know, Saudi Arabia, that felt like we were occupying, and even there was no suicide terrorism before the Iraqi war in Iraq. You know, it's hard to believe it, but even under Saddam Hussein, there was more tolerance there. You know, Christians lived there, and half of them now have been run out of the country.
Right.
So it's the occupation. He's convinced me of that, and we should understand that. That doesn't excuse them. I mean, they're still criminals, they're still murderers, and, you know, all these things, and we have to deal with it, but we ought to understand why it occurs so maybe we can neutralize it. And besides, changing our policy shouldn't be a big deal, because it's only changing the policy to what I think is a wonderful policy of non-intervention,
right,
following the Constitution, the advice of the founders. It's very practical. Besides, we can't afford this warmongering stuff that we do anyway.
Certainly.
We're going broke.